We're going to read verse 11 through to the end of the chapter. So starting at verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable, verse 11. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired men have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men.'" So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Your brother has come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him." "My son," the father said, "you were always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found."
Dava, thank you for reading for us. If you'd like to turn to Luke 15, if you shut it, it'd be great if you could keep it open on page 1048. Let's take a trip to Petticoat Lane Market. It's only a few minutes up the road, so you won't even have to put your coat on. We're not going to go hunting for bargains. We're going to do a little bit of research. We're going to ask one question. There are no lifelines, and you have to give the first answer that comes into your head. Here's the question. Name one story Jesus told. I reckon most people who can answer the question would either say the Good Samaritan or the Prodigal Son. The Prodigal Son is one of the most famous stories in Western literature. It's so famous that we're going to spend the next 4 weeks looking at it and the stories which surround it in Luke chapter 15 of Luke's Gospel. But fame isn't without its problems. The story of the prodigal has been used and abused. On the one hand, the story has been romanticized. The prodigal as James Dean, a rebel without a cause, an icon of cool. You can see him walking away from his father's house with a sneer and a black leather jacket. It's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But the story has been sentimentalized too, hasn't it? It's an everyday tale of a dysfunctional family. A disheveled son rejects the bright lights of the city in favour of the simple pleasures of his country home. And his old dad is delighted. There are violins and Kleenex as they embrace one another. Hollywood fights to buy the rights from Mills and Boone. Love conquers all. Now, both those things, the romanticization of the prodigal and the sentimentalization of his return, happen when you tear the story of the prodigal out of its original setting in Luke chapter 15. We're going to do some restoration work this morning, work which will strip away the romance and the sentiment which have grown up around the story. Hopefully, by the end, we'll begin to hear the story as it was originally intended to be heard. And hopefully, we will feel the shock of the story too. The crucial question we have to ask in order to unlock the meaning of the prodigal son is this. Why did Jesus tell the story of the prodigal son? Why did Jesus tell the story of the prodigal son? The answer might shock you and make you rethink everything you thought to be true about yourself and Jesus Christ. So please keep listening. The answer to our question comes in the opening three verses of Luke chapter 15. Let me read them to you again. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering round to hear Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Can you see? Jesus tells the story of the prodigal, along with the two stories of the coin and the sheep, which we'll look at next week, in order to answer the accusation of the Pharisees and teachers of the law in verse 3. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Now, let's clear away some of the misunderstandings surrounding these verses. Here's the first one. First, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were religious extremists. Maybe that's what you think. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law were religious extremists. Well, the truth is, they weren't. There were plenty of religious extremists around in the time of Jesus, but they weren't the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. The extreme religious right wing of the day were either out in the desert keeping their distance from the Roman occupying power, or they had become terrorists trying to drive them out to liberate God's land. The extreme liberal or left-wing religious people of the day had watered down the demands of their religion in order to snuggle up close to the Romans, to take away anything which might offend them. The Pharisees and teachers of the law were mainstream, moral, Old Testament believing synagogue goers. This was mainstream, respectable religion. In fact, the Pharisees were probably very similar to many of us here today. Respectable, good, moral people. We don't much care for religious extremists of any persuasion, do we? Right wing, left wing. We'll stay in the mainstream. We'll live our lives by the Ten Commandments and try and be pillars of the community. You can see the picture, can't you? Good, moral, religious, respectable people. Maybe the picture is a bit fuzzy in London, because maybe we're a slightly more irreligious than the mainstream of Britain. The picture is a lot more confused, but it's certainly not quite as confused if you go out into the shires. It's not something that I'd recommend doing too often, stay close to home in the safety of the city. But last weekend I was back in Winchester, where I lived for 4 years. I'm not picking on Winchester. Winchester is a lovely city. If you've never been there, do visit it. But I'm talking about it because it's a city that I know. Winchester is a city of about 30,000 people, and it has 30 churches in it. Isn't that extraordinary? It must be one of the most over-churched places in the whole of Britain. It has an extremely ancient cathedral with the longest nave in Europe. I know how long it is because I've had to walk it a few times. It has an ancient public school. The army have been based in Winchester. It has a crown court and prison. It at one time was the richest city in the whole of Britain. It's an affluent town. And it's full of decent, respectable, religious people. People who you'd delighted to have them as your next door neighbour. You'd love them to be teaching your children. You'd love them to be shaping them and influencing them. Now, it's exactly those sorts of people who Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son against. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law. The shocking thing is that the character at the end of the story, the elder brother, is meant to represent them, arguing with the father and refusing to join the party. Jesus appears to be saying respectable, moral, religious people are more likely to be farther away from God than the people they hate most. It's a shock, isn't it? Because a popular view of religion, maybe your view of religion, says that the people closest to God are the good, the religious, and the moral. Go to church, keep your nose clean, and God will like you. The shock of Luke 15 is that you might have called yourself a Christian for years, and yet Jesus says, in your heart you are far from God. You might be a member of the clergy, a faithful servant of the church, a church warden, a good small group member, a member of staff, a small group leader at St. Helens, a children's leader, and yet you are far from God. You are with the elder brother. You are an elder brother who deep down hates the grace of God. And you will express that by trying to make your church an exclusive club. And by being offended when people gatecrash who don't fit the bill. A few weeks ago, I was having lunch with a friend who'd been a minister up in Scotland. And he was telling me about the experience of one of his colleagues, who was also a minister in Scotland, who had a Sunday off. So as ministers and vicars tended to do, he thought to himself, where can I visit? Where can I check out to have a look as to what they are up to? So he thumbed through the equivalent of the Church Yellow Pages in Scotland, which I'd imagine is a fairly thick book, isn't it? Lots of churches up in Scotland. And he found one. He thought, I'd like to check that out this Sunday. So he went along, and as he approached the front door, the person who was there handing out the hymn books or the psalm books looked him up and down and said to him, are you sure you want to come in here? Isn't that extraordinary? It's true. It's true. Looked him up and down and said, are you sure that you want to come in here? And by that point, he was convinced that he didn't want to go in. So he went elsewhere. Now, I hope that's never happened to you at St. Helens. I'm sure it never has. Our welcome team do a great job, don't they, in being warm and inviting at the front door. But you see, that's an attitude of heart, even though we may not express it with our lips. It's an attitude of heart which says, are you sure you want to come in here? You're really not like us, are you? In fact, you look fairly irreligious and not particularly respectable. "Are you sure you want to come in here?" Now we'll see what that looks like in more detail right at the end of the 4 weeks when we come to look at the elder brother. So do come back for that. But the Pharisees weren't religious extremists. That's the first misunderstanding. They were people like you. They were people like me. Good, decent, moral, religious people. Well, let's look at a second misunderstanding. This is it. The Pharisees had no reason to mutter against Jesus. The Pharisees had no reason to mutter against Jesus. Well, look at the reason they mutter against him in verse 2. Can you see it? "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Now, who were the sinners? If you look back at verse 1, you'll see that the Bible translators have put inverted commas around the word sinners. They're telling us that it's a technical term, that it means something more than we might imagine. It refers to people who were considered to be persona non grata in mainstream religious circles. If you read Luke's Gospel, you'll discover that they were prostitutes, they were lepers, they were Samaritans, they were tax collectors. They were people, because of the lifestyle they lived or the diseases they had contracted, were considered to be beyond the bounds of respectable religion. And they were pushed to the fringes of the religious community. If they tried to get into the temple or the synagogue, they would have been turned away at the door. It's the bloke who works on the desk next to you who blasphemes his way through the day. It's the lovely couple who live next door to you with a delightful family who would never ever dream of going to church or even believing in God in a million years. It's the woman next door who loves to tell you the details of her sexual exploits with many different men. It's the neighbor who boosts his income, getting paid cash in hand for dodgy deals down the pub. It's the irreligious. People who don't think twice about God, certainly wouldn't go to church, and if they did, the person on the door would think twice about letting them in. It's the people who aren't naturally in your local synagogue or church. And Jesus is not only talking with them, he's showing them the ultimate sign of acceptance in his culture. He's eating with them. So you see, haven't the Pharisees got a point? Aren't they right to mutter about Jesus? Imagine you pop down your local newsagent next Sunday morning on your way to church. You pick up the Sunday edition of your favourite broadsheet, but your eyes are drawn to the headline in the news of the world: "Saucy City Vicar in Sexy Soho Shock. Pictures inside." You can't resist it, so you discreetly, after you've looked both ways, slip it inside your broadsheet. And you pay for them both at the counter. You rush back to the car, turn to the vicar story on page 6, only to see a picture of me in Soho, in a bar, laughing and eating a meal with some of the area's most notorious prostitutes and pimps. How are you meant to react? You might give me the benefit of the doubt and suspect some kind of tabloid setup. Or you might be on the phone to the church wardens demanding what's going on and what's going to be done about it. You know that this looks at best, well, probably unwise in your thinking, or at worst, it's some kind of moral failure. Aren't the Pharisees right to mutter about Jesus? Haven't we seen lots of people who, maybe with the best of intentions, have ended up on a slippery road to disaster? Isn't Jesus playing with fire Isn't he being soft on sin and the causes of sin? What's he doing hanging out with people who'd never go near a church, let alone be let in? The moral, respectable Pharisees have got every right to mutter, haven't they? Hasn't he got his reputation to consider? After all, he's a role model for young, impressionable Jewish boys. Well, Jesus tells the stories of the lost sheep, lost coin, and the lost son to justify his behavior and his priorities. The basic theme of all the stories, as we'll see, is that God's priority is to look for people who appear to be a long way from him. They are described as the lost and the dead. Jesus says that there is nothing which brings God more joy than to see these people found and restored to him. Whether they are a long way from him because of their respectability, or whether they are a long way from him because of their immorality and lack of respectability, there is nothing which brings God more joy than seeing them brought home to him. It's shocking, isn't it? The way Jesus sees it, the religious and the respectable are on the outside, muttering. The sinners are on the inside, gathering around to hear him and being welcomed home. It was a wonderful line, wasn't it, in our first hymn? I don't know, it was about verse 3 it struck me. You can check it at the end of the service, where it refers to this strange, matchless grace. It is strange, isn't it? The respectable muttering, the irreligious gathering round to hear him. Well, let me talk to various of us here this morning. Some of us, maybe all of us here this morning, have dark secrets in our lives. Maybe buried deep in the past. Maybe hidden just out of public sight in the present. We think our outward respectability is paper thin, and we live in constant fear of exposure. If people knew what I was really like, if people knew what I'd done or think of doing, then they'd be appalled. You know that terrible feeling when your secret is mentioned in general conversation and you work hard to subtly change the subject? You know it? You know the deep secrets that are there in your life. There's a piece in one of the colour supplements yesterday called Don't Get Exhausted, Get a Life. And it was written by somebody who I think describes herself, let me check it, as a health coach. Is that interesting? A health coach. You can have a number at the end if your ears perked up. Don't get exhausted, get a life. And she said this, in fact she was quoting a colleague here. Most of my clients, many being high-flying male executives, suffer from what doctors refer to as TAT, tired all the time syndrome. I had one client who had worked 16-hour days in the city battling chronic fatigue, doing a job she hated for 10 years, all because she wanted to prove to her father that she could do maths. Can you see? Dark secrets driving us. Over and over again, I see my clients people-pleasing, spending time with people they don't even like, working like dogs just to buy clothes, cars, and houses to prove to themselves and to others that they're somebody. It's not surprising we have no energy if we spend our whole lives in an exhausting pantomime that actually has nothing to do with what we want to do, but all about our fears of who we think we're not. It's true, isn't it? Deep, dark secrets which drive us. Now, this is where it gets sad, where she gives her recipe to get out of it. First step is to start believing in your own worth. Identify the belief that's running your show. I'm not good enough. I'm a fake. They'll discover I'm no good soon. And change it. What do you need to believe to create the life you adore? then start logging evidence to support your new beliefs. I was a good, steady journalist who always got copy in on time, and editors valued that. I was enthusiastic and kind, and people loved those qualities. On a good hair day and in the right lighting, I could look great. It takes around 100 pieces of evidence before a new belief will start to flourish. A month before life begins to change. She halved her hours and doubled her rates and bought in various other things to help her feel good about herself. It's not much to go on, is it? Because we know, or I know about myself, that for every 100 pieces of evidence to say I'm a great bloke, there are another 200 pieces of evidence which will tell me the contrary. Deep, dark secrets which drive us. Listen, and listen well, and listen well over the next 4 weeks. If you've been found by Jesus, if you've found your way back to the Father's home, then you have nothing to fear. The Father dances with the angels because you were dead and you are alive. If that is true, then who cares about the mutterings of the Pharisee? You can let the mask drop and know the Father's forgiveness and know the beginnings of change. Not by building evidence that you are a great person, but by admitting that you are not, and yet knowing that the Father loves you, embraces you, and dances with the angels because of you. You can be honest when you have known the Father's kiss. It doesn't mean that you'll tell your story at every opportunity. It doesn't mean that you'll be sharing your secrets left, right, and center. But it does mean that your life will no longer be ruled by the fear of exposure. Keep coming back, because this chapter may be the best news that you have heard in a long time. Some of us, others of us, are wondering what on earth we're doing here. We don't count ourselves religious. We've been turned off by the church all our lives. Our lives are ragged and they are irreligious. We are not in the least bit churchy. We're here because a relative has dragged us along, or we're staying with friends for the weekend, and it would have been a bit impolite to stay in bed reading the Sunday papers. Listen to Jesus. He says that the obstacles preventing you coming home to his Father are far fewer than the obstacles which prevent the religious and the respectable coming home to him. There is no exam to pass of respectability or religiosity in order to come home to God. The striking thing that he'll go on to say in his parables is that right now God is searching for you and would rejoice if you would return to him. Keep coming back, pester your friend to stay with him in another couple of weeks to see what it will mean for you to come home to God. But finally, some of us here this morning are offended, quite frankly. You're thinking, why is he so down on me? There is nothing wrong with respectability and high moral standards. There is nothing wrong with regularly attending church. Well, in one way, you are exactly right. There is nothing wrong with respectability and high moral standards. Jesus never ever lifts up the lives of these sinners as a moral model to follow. The prodigal does terrible things. Jesus has come to find them and to bring them life, which will demand change. But the very fact that you are feeling offended reveals that you do not understand the Father's heart. Your muttering masks your spiritual lostness and hard-heartedness. Because when you begin to see the heartbeat of the Father, then you realize that he welcomes lost sinners. And he welcomes them because he loves them. Not because of their morality or their respectability. He welcomes them because he loves them. And he has welcomed you not because of your respectability and your morality. He welcomes you because he loves you, not because of the things you do. So if that's you this morning, if you are feeling got at and offended, listen to the invitation. Don't allow your morality and respectability to turn you into an elder brother and make you more lost than the prodigal. Come on in, Jesus says. Come on in. Join the Father's party and rejoice that what was lost is found. So as we come to the Lord's table this morning, do you come muttering against Jesus and his graceful ways? Or will you gather and eat and drink as a sinner saved by grace, delighted to hear the graceful, comfortable words that Christ Jesus came into this world to save sinners? Let's pray.